The Soldier. I matriculated from Damland at the age of 17 and a half and proceeded to join the army. In those days we had military conscription, which in simple terms meant that you were compelled to accept an invitation for free food, natty clothes, and a lodging for a period of 2 years. At the time I was still keen to become a pilot, and although I had submitted my application to join the Air Force, I was initially drafted to 4SI, 4th South African Infantry Battalion, based in Middelburg in the Eastern Transvaal, now Mpumalanga. After a few weeks of basic training, I was sent to an Air Force base in Pretoria for candidate pilot selection. By that stage, my any youthful, glamorous expectations of being a pilot in the military had been blown out of the window. This was only after a few weeks of basic training and being chased around. Mostly this indoctrination was supplied by halfwits who could not spell army. But because they had 2 stripes on their arm, they expected to be treated and obeyed like gods. The racial indoctrination that was dished out by these halfwits and the general disorganization that I experienced on a daily basis made me question whether I could commit to the Air Force on a permanent force basis. Nonetheless, I joined several hundred other wannabe pilots in Pretoria to undergo the many different physical, medical, and intellectual tests that were part of the selection process. If memory serves me correctly, they only selected approximately 20 individuals from the hundreds of applicants. I passed all the various tests and made it to a short list of 30-odd hopefuls. We were then interviewed by a selection panel, which consisted of several high-ranking officers who bombarded you with all sorts of questions. I seem to recall that this is where I came unstuck. As I've never been shy to venture an opinion, given the opportunity, I probably said something I shouldn't have. It may have been accurate, but I probably said it at an inopportune time. As it turned out, I was not going to be faced with the dilemma of deciding whether or not to join the permanent force. They concluded that I was not to be one of the 20 ideal pilot candidates, and I was dispatched back to the infantry battalion to be trained to shoot terrorists and possibly learn to manage my opinions. Lessons learned. 7. It is important to dream, and more important to pursue your dreams, even if, in the end, your dream does not meet your expectations or you happen to change your mind. 8. At times you will encounter people of lesser spiritual or mental maturity than yourself. Learn to accept them and do not judge them, as they have their own journey to travel, which is neither more or less important than that of your own. Upon my return to 4SI, I decided I wanted to join the officers' training course, which was based at the infantry school in Oudtshoorn in the Southeast Cape. Unfortunately, I was too late. The selection process had taken place while I was mouthing off in Pretoria. This left me with precious little choice, so I went with the best alternative specialist training opportunity and joined the Army Intelligence Corps. Yes, we all know that the two words are an oxymoron and should never be used in the same sentence, let alone one after the other, but hey, I had to do something that might impress the young ladies I met on my first weekend pass. After about 4 months of intense training, we were ready for our first mini-border tour. I use the word training reservedly because it was purely a form of basic human degradation and political indoctrination. For some of the halfwits with 2 stripes, it was a period during which they were able to indulge in their sadomasochistic fantasies. My first border tour was to the Zimbabwe-Rhodesian border for a period of 6 weeks. So there I was, not yet 18, running around the bush looking for terrorists, that is, black people, to shoot. Ironically, at that age, I was not allowed to drive a vehicle, I could not vote, and I was not allowed to legally buy alcohol, and yet everyone in South Africa was resting peacefully, knowing that the full might of our military force was protecting them. Scary. Not the border, but the public's naivete. Prior to our introductory all-expenses-paid tour to the exotic Rhodesian border, we were promised a 4-day weekend pass on our return. This was because we were due to serve a 3-month stint on what was then referred to as the Southwest African border. We were due to depart the week following our return from the Rhodesian border. But just before we got back from our 6-week tour, we were told for no apparent reason that our leave had been cancelled. Instead, we could have a visitor's day at the base in Middelburg on the Sunday to say farewell to our loved ones. Needless to say, this caused great unhappiness, and I, in my quest for fairness and consistency, decided to do something about it. Displaying great leadership, or idiotic lunacy, I managed to garner the support of in excess of 80% of the troops who were affected by this hugely inconsiderate change of plans made by the high-ranking officers. So I planned my first military operation, which I codenamed Operation Play Fair. The plan was simple. When we returned to our base at Middelburg, and after all the preparations for the border tour the following week were completed, we would leave the base en masse. This was planned for late on Wednesday night. We believed we had every right to enjoy the 4-day break we had been promised. We all agreed to be back at 1800 hours on the Sunday evening. The plan sounded fair and reasonable to me. At least 120 other dedicated, fearless soldiers had given me their word that they were committed to the operation. I felt that there was little that the powers that be could do to us. After all, we had strength in numbers. That was the theory. In the end, there were only 12 of us that stuck to the plan. So much for my other comrades. You know, the dedicated, fearless soldiers I mentioned earlier. I received a call at home early on the Thursday morning to inform me that I should get back to the base as all hell was breaking loose. Our sergeant major was threatening to have us arrested, subjected to a court-martial and then shot at dawn as we were cowards who had deserted in the face of the enemy and blah, 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 blah. I made a decision to go back on the Sunday morning with my parents and share the visitor's day with them. I figured that, although I was a deserting coward, there was no way that they were going to shoot me, and certainly not in front of my parents. Of course I was worried, concerned, and nervous, but I had made a choice, and I had to deal with the consequences. In the end, it wasn't too bad. The 12 of us were christened the Dirty Dozen by the Sergeant Major. We were given a good working over in terms of physical punishment, you know, 14 gazillion push-ups, running with cases of rifle ammunition, etc. This punishment was extended into the fully paid, totally sold-out tour to the luscious northern region of Southwest Africa. We were entrusted with the important tasks of digging lots of latrines, long drops, as they were known, no functional description is necessary, in the base camp situated in Oshivelo, where we had to acclimatise. After about 2 weeks, they disbanded the Dirty Dozen, and life went back to normal. Army normal, that is. Lessons learned? 9. Pursue your beliefs if they are aligned with your principles. 10. Do not expect people to always do what they say, despite assurances they may give you. 11. Accept that there are consequences to every decision you make, and be prepared to deal with those consequences without blaming other people. After our acclimatization period, we were moved further north to a base called Ogongo, which was the headquarters of 52 Psi Battalion. I was stationed there for a period of almost 18 months, as I served out the balance of my compulsory 2-year army vacation. It was a particularly interesting and exciting period during which I was involved in the planning and execution of many military operations, although this time they were sanctioned, unlike Operation Play Fair. During this period, I met an individual who has been the most influential leader I have ever been exposed to. His name was Commandant James Richard Hills, an ex-parabat who was appointed as the commanding officer of 52 Psi. I had already been there for almost 3 months when he arrived and decided to change things quite dramatically in our little paradise. Despite his extremely English name, he could barely speak a word of English. By this time, I mostly spoke Afrikaans anyway, so it was not too much of a problem. He redesigned the camp, the trenches, those are the foxholes, the position of the tents, etc. This required a lot of labour, so we were not too excited about this extreme makeover army edition. What made things worse was that there was hardly any water in the camp, so it was not always possible to shower. We were somewhat reluctant to work up a sweat in the searing heat without being able to wash afterwards. As it turned out, within a week of the camp's extreme makeover, we were mortar-bombed one night, and had the camp not been changed, we would have suffered severe casualties. Suddenly, we were all pretty keen to follow his lead. A hilarious event occurred during the water bombing. Harry, a fellow intelligence officer who shared a tent with me and two others, had returned from 2 weeks' leave on the same day that we'd finished moving the tents and had dug the new trenches. In the middle of the night when the first bombs started exploding, he was still somewhat disorientated, as he'd been sleeping peacefully for the past 2 weeks. Eventually he remembered where he was and out of pure habit ran and dived in the direction of where the trenches had been. Needless to say, he landed face first on hard sand. We all witnessed this event and collapsed laughing for the next few minutes, so much so that we paid little attention to the bombing itself. Despite Commandant Hill's seniority in terms of rank, he treated everyone as equals. He would not make you do anything that he would not do himself. In most instances, he would do it first, then tell you to do it. He was a fitness freak, that is, an obsessive fanatic with a passion. And whenever we were in base, we had the pleasure of having to run 10 kilometres every afternoon in full kit around the dusty track. A minor fact that we had no water to shower in afterwards would certainly not deter his fondness for physical expression. He would run in the front, dictating the pace, demonstrating how to do 100 push-ups, fully kitted, as a way of taking a breather during the run, before making us do the same. Now this was distinctly different to all the other striped half-wits that loved sending us on little jaunts all over the place while they relaxed under the shade of some tree, drinking an ice-cold soda. In a short period of time, Commandant Hills had the whole battalion eating out of his hand. There was nothing we would not do for him. He never seemed to issue commands, and I grew quite fond of him, and despite my lowly rank, yes, I had become one of those striped species, but never a half-wit, though. He would always seek my opinion on many operations we planned. Now, these operations were conducted both within the Southwest African territory as well as within Angola, which was only a few kilometres away. He had a permanent force captain as his chief of intelligence, who he could call on, but for some reason he valued my opinion. In fact, maybe it would be fair to say that this particular captain was not the sharpest tool in the shed. On one occasion, when we were in the base, I for some reason decided not to wear my boots and walked into the intelligence room wearing sandals with my uniform. He asked me why I was not wearing my boots, and I quickly informed him that I had tonsillitis, so I couldn't wear them. He grunted, "Okay," and walked off. Probably an hour or so later, he came back to ask me what tonsillitis has to do with the fact that I couldn't wear boots. I couldn't stop myself from bursting out into a fit of laughter. Fortunately, he saw the funny side of it. I had won the battle, but he had won the war, as he ordered me to go and put my boots on. I recall an incident when Commandant Hills came and woke me up in my tent at about 3 o'clock so that I could tear holes in his plan. Despite the hour and his rank, I negotiated that he would go and make me coffee, and I would report for duty in a couple of minutes. As always, his plans were meticulous and well thought out. Seldom could I pick holes in them. Even so, I always enjoyed these encounters when I attempted to match wits with this experienced professional soldier. On the many operations that he and I participated in, we shared another personal challenge. Out in the bush at dawn, it was customary for the lower-ranking soldier to make the higher-ranking officer his early morning coffee. I've already stated that I tend to rebel against what is considered to be the norm, if it does not make sense to me. This particular custom did not make sense to me, so Commandant Hills would lie there in his sleeping bag and start urging me to fulfill my duty, he would say. So die asseblief kom, maak vir jou commandant a bikkie koffie, which basically means, Englishman, please make your commandant some coffee, to which I would always reply, nee, commandant, ek kan nie lekker koffie maak nie. Commandant maak beter koffie as ek, which loosely translated means, no, commandant, I can't make decent coffee. You make better coffee than me. Normally what followed was that he would curse, get up, and make us both coffee. This little game happened every day that we were in the bush. Not once did I make him coffee, and not once did he pull rank and order me to do so. During my time there, I witnessed many ugly incidents, but that is part of war. Fortunately, there were many memorable ones as well. One of my duties was to interrogate captured prisoners. From the outset, I want to state that I never, ever personally touched a prisoner, nor did I ever give any orders for anyone else to do so. During any interrogation, my role was to ask questions, to obtain information. This is not to say that these interrogations were harmless. Sadly, some humans derive immense pleasure from hurting others. It is something I never condoned, but could not prevent. In one amusing interrogation, we had a prisoner who was talking in riddles and professing to be a soldier of all the various armies that were operating during those times. He was first MPLA, then SWAPO, then he told us he was from FNLA, and finally he decided that he was from Teuswach, the local Southwest African Territory Force. A new intelligence officer had just joined our battalion, and this was his first interrogation. We had a local black interpreter who was trying his best to explain to the prisoner that if he didn't cooperate, he would end up suffering severe pain. After some time, the new intelligence officer lost his cool and pressed his 9mm pistol against the prisoner's forehead and started screaming at him that he was about to shoot him. He then quickly pulled his firearm downward towards the ground and squeezed off a shot. The shot happened to go through the interpreter's boot, which made him jump around holding his injured foot, yelling with pain. This was so funny that even the prisoner packed up laughing. We were in hysterics, and the officer stormed off in a huff. So much for his baptism in interrogation. Fortunately, the bullet had not damaged any bones in the interpreter's foot. In fact, it went straight through and was able to heal quickly. While I was up on the border, my sister decided to get married. Now, during my hectic partying days while still at Damlin College, I had a group of friends that were a few years older than me. There was one character by the name of Ricky, who was a fighter, a Romeo, a good dancer, the South African version of John Travolta. Yes, those were the days of Saturday Night Fever. The only thing that Rocky loved more than his reflection in the mirror was himself. Linda had asked me to introduce him. I was dead against it, as they were like oil and vinegar. After much pressure from her, I eventually did, and sure as night follows day, they got involved and fell in love. Soon after that, marriage plans unfolded. Linda had told me about the wedding date, and I said that if I could manage to get leave from the border, I would attend the wedding, but it was unlikely. I spoke to Commandant Hills, and he kindly agreed to give me 7 days' leave and a train ticket from Grootfontein to Johannesburg. The train ticket was a pretty standard thing for border leave, but nobody actually used it, as it would take you 3 days by train to get there and another 3 days to get back. Great for 7 days' leave, don't you think? The norm was to trade this ticket in and pay in the difference to a South African Airways flight from Windhoek to Johannesburg. For once, I would conform to the norm. I decided not to tell Linda the good news and to surprise her with my attendance. 2 days before my official leave was due to start, I had to accompany a dead terrorist body from our Ogongo base to Oshakati. We had no morgues or cooler rooms, so the corpse had been brewing in the plastic body bag for a day or two prior to my departure. It was a typically hot day in May, and I was sitting in a biffle which was an open troop carrier. At the end of a trip of about 80 minutes, I was proud of myself as I had not spilled my breakfast all over the body bag. When we arrived at Oshakati, I bade farewell to my precious cargo. We had some time to kill while we waited for our rations vehicle to be replenished. Someone mentioned that there was a convoy leading from Oshakati to Tsumeb a few hours later. This was an ideal opportunity because, I figured, I would be able to get to Tsumeb in time to catch another convoy from Tsumeb to Windhoek. The only issue was that I wasn't prepared for a trip back to South Africa, as all that I was wearing was my uniform with a short-sleeved shirt. I had my rifle, no wallet, in fact nothing. I decided to contact my base via radio and asked to speak to Commandant Hills. I told him that although it was 2 days earlier than my leave was scheduled, it was an ideal opportunity. After some persuasion, he finally agreed to let me go. He sent through authorization for Oshakati to issue me a train ticket. Now all I had to do was to put some money together so I could pay for the air ticket. I spoke to some soldiers who'd accompanied me on the trip and took all the cash they had. In return, I gave them the key for my locker, which contained my wallet. I was on my way. I caught a ride in the convoy and headed to Tsumeb. The trip was slow. We ended up missing the convoy that left for Windhoek. No problem. I decided to hitchhike. This was not too dangerous, as at that time there was little terrorist activity so far south. Not for a second did I think it would be difficult to get lifts from the local population, as I was a soldier who was risking his life to defend their country. Wrong. I managed to eventually get a lift to a small town called Ochiborongo, and there I stood. In May, the evenings are cool to cold, and I was standing in my short sleeves at midnight with not a soul in sight. The local police chief saw me and asked what I was up to. I explained that I was trying to get to Windhoek to catch a flight back. He said that there was no way that I would get a lift that night, so he invited me to sleep in his brand new jail. He even promised not to lock it. He said he would wake me up at 5 o'clock so that I could catch the train to Windhoek, which should get me there by about 8 o'clock. This was a double first. I was the first person to sleep in the brand new jail, and it was the first time, and hopefully the only time, I would ever have the privilege of sleeping in jail. True to his word, he woke me up and took me to the station, or more correctly, walked me there. After all, this was a very small town. I arrived in Windhoek at 8 o'clock, but I needed to get to the travel agent by no later than 8:30, as they had a shuttle that left from their offices at 8:35 to get to the airport, which, due to the terrain, was located a long way out of town. I scrambled off the train, tried to find a bus, but no luck. I asked where the travel agency was and started to run. I was running down the main street, and when I looked at the time, I knew I wasn't going to make it, so I did the next best thing. At the traffic lights, a car had stopped on the red, and his passenger door was unlocked. I opened the door and barked, "Get me to this address, and quickly!" He obviously got a fright seeing an armed man, albeit in uniform, jump into his car, but he did what he was told, and I managed to get there on time. I finally got to the airport and boarded a Swiss Air Boeing 747 flight that had flown from Zurich via Windhoek en route to Johannesburg. Oh, I must have looked a mess. I was dusty, unshaven, red-eyed, and pissed off with the local population. Wisely, the passengers kept their distance, possibly because of my somewhat disheveled appearance, or maybe it was because of my body odor. I'm not sure. Not important. I was on my way home. Nobody knew I was coming home, so I wasn't getting excited to see my greeting parties. I stepped off the plane. I could have called my parents, but decided to take the shuttle service from the airport to Braamfontein. From there, I walked across the bridge and quite a long way to where my sister worked. If I was going to surprise her, I may as well do it properly. While walking through downtown Johannesburg, a car backfired. Instinctively, I hit the ground and had my rifle in the firing position. This was just like another day back at the office, except I was thousands of kilometers away from the real danger. People fled, screaming around me. I suddenly realized what I had done, and if I could have swallowed myself up, I would have. I slowly got back to my feet and slunk off. You would have thought that they might have understood. Anyway, the surprise and joy on Linda's face was worth all the trouble that I'd taken to get there. I was able to attend her wedding. My last encounter with Commandant Hills was on the morning of my final day on the border early in December 1980. My two other intelligence comrades who had spent the last 18 months with me at 52 Sai and I were due to depart via vehicle from Ogongo to Oshakati, Sector 10 headquarters. From there we would travel to Ondongwa, Air Force headquarters, from where we would fly on a military plane back to South Africa. Flights from Ondongwa at this time of the year were always fully booked, as the permanent force members would fly back to South Africa for their December vacations. If you missed your flight, then you could end up waiting for days before you got lucky. As it happened on this day, the vehicle convoy from Ogongo had been cancelled for some reason. This made me extremely unhappy, and clearly it was visible to Commandant Hills as he walked into the intelligence room. He asked me what the problem was, and I explained our predicament. He asked me why this was so important to me, and I said that after 18 months on the border, although I had had 1 week of leave every 6 months, I just wanted to get back to civilian life. He then left the room and returned about 30 minutes later to tell us to get our butts to the helicopter pad, that a Puma troop-carrying helicopter was due to land any minute to come and fetch us and drop us off at Ondongwa so that we could make our flight back home. I was astounded. Here he had requested a large helicopter to fly from Ondongwa to fetch us. I don't know what strings he pulled or what reasons he gave, because this unnecessary use of military transport is a no-no at any time, let alone during military operations. He came to me, shook my hand, hugged me, and said probably the only English words that he'd ever spoken to me, "Soti, look after yourself." With that, he turned and left, and we scampered off to the helicopter pad. And that was the end of my military experience. After 2 years, I left the army at the age of 19 and a half. I had seen and experienced a lot of horrendous situations, seen the cheapness of life, seen young African teenagers with little or no training lose their lives fighting because they had to, because if they did not, they and their families would have been killed anyway. I had seen friends lose their lives, seen friends lose their limbs, and seen the futility of someone else's war that was unwinnable. It was only a question of time until we withdrew our forces. I knew it then, but I did not expect it to take so many years eventually to happen. There were upsides, though. I was young, I was alive, I now had my driver's license, I could now vote, and I could now legally buy alcohol. Lessons learned. 12. A position or station or rank that you may hold in life does not mean you are a leader. 13. A true leader leads by example. 14. A true leader treats all people equally. 15. A true leader does not expect you to do anything that they cannot do themselves. 16. A true leader never commands you to do anything. They request that you do it. 17. A true leader earns your respect as they want you to respect them, and not their position or rank or station in life.